Welcome to Stories from the Pitch, a podcast dedicated to creating a living social history book about street performing and some of the crazy characters who populate this world. I've been hanging out with Robert in Pahoa, Hawaii this week, working away on the podcast and connecting with some great folks for some upcoming shows that I'm really excited about. This week's show goes back to a conversation Robert had with Dave Altman back in December. Dave got his start in Key West, Florida back in the late 70s after deciding to head south to escape the winter. Will Soto, Alexi Lee, Tim Satimi, and Magical Mystical Michael were all a part of the Sunset Celebration scene in Mallory Square at the time, and all had an influence on his style and career. Florida State University's Flying High Circus program also pops up in the conversation, which leads to some great stories and characters. Climate, lifestyle, and mentors all contributed to a career that spanned more than 30 years and continues to this day. And now, here's Robert.
Matters not the job you've got.
The greatest icons of the street performing world.
As long as you do it well.
Never been so excited in my whole life.
Things that are made by plants well laid, the test of time will tell.
I knew I was going to get a little flack from each one of you.
You cannot count or know the amount.
I can do anything.
Or the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand.
Because no one really cares about me.
I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.
I'm talking to Dave Altman. Is that your office you're in right now?
Yeah, such as it is.
Have you at all been familiar with what's happening with the Busker Hall of Fame?
No, I haven't.
What David has been trying to do, I think, or at least what we've been trying to do together, is to get some stories from the world of busking and try to relive that time. And in the same vein, maybe if we can help out a new person or lend some insight into what we did, how we did it, how we ended up, I think it might have a reason or a purpose for being there, not just a fun thing to do to pat ourselves all on the back. The reason I participate in this is that I felt I was given a wonderful gift by being inspired by the likes of Founce and Cyrus and the early people that I saw in Faneuil Hall, the Shakespeare brothers, Don and Lana Reed. And these people, through their inspiration, gave me an opportunity to get enough guts up to go try it myself. And I think the type of life that I got to lead because of it, it's like a miracle. It almost like showed me who I was as a person. And I think that's ultimately why I personally feel a debt to the busking community. And I would like to pass that on.
And my inspiration was the exact same people.
Right. Isn't it interesting that those same people just inspired so many buskers? I mean, Balance just took me under his wing my very first day as a busker. And hell, I was his competition. I was performing right next to them. I had no idea who they were. All I knew is that they had this huge crowd around them and that they were obviously very good at what they did. And I was 100% green. I had never done any show talking before. I had juggled to music before, but I had never spoken to a crowd. And as you well know, there were no boom boxes or anything you could carry around to play music way back in the 70s. So,
And I'm kind of a purist that way. To me, is if you can afford a microphone, sound system, get off the streets and let somebody else do it. But
I understand what you're saying, but you know, there's these guys out there trying to make a living, and all of a sudden somebody comes next to them with a sound system, blows them out of the water. How are they going to compete? So
to me, street theater, you know, goes back thousands of years, and it's just the performer, his voice, and just the visual of it. When you start adding these electronic things, It takes away from the tradition of street performing.
I agree with you 100%. Although I can rationalize the use of a microphone, certainly in a festival atmosphere. Give us a little bit of background on your history with busking and maybe a story or two.
Sure. Well, I started out juggling back in 75. I just taught myself how to juggle with three tennis balls. And I didn't do much with it for a few years. I learned how to do four. But I was all self-taught. I'd never even talked to another juggler. And then I moved to Key West, and I started hanging out with the street performers there. Let's see, there was Will Soto, of course.
Of course.
Lexi. You know Alexis Lee. Well, she would shows with Will at that time. And we were basically on the same juggling level. She was doing two balls and a plunger, you know, and doing a few tricks off of that. And so Will was mentoring her at the time. Tim Satimi was down there doing mime on roller skates. Scotty was down there. A year or so later, there was Evan from Heaven, who was from Colorado, that did a slack wire. Then there was Magical Mystical Michael.
Right.
He was a magician. And I probably got more about performing from him than anybody else.
What did you see?
Even though he was not a juggler.
What did you see in Magical Mystical Michael that made you want to be a performer?
Well, he was an actor. He didn't improvise very much at all. And his delivery was very consistent. It was well polished. And his facial expressions were just right on, you know. It was just like watching a play. The whole thing was tight. Every movement that he did was carefully choreographed and went to the next one. He had this great big old bushy beard with bells woven into it. He had, you know, a gypsy type of a look to him. And I just loved the way the audience reacted to his show. I saw him like 20 years later, 15, 20 years later, I guess. I was a little disappointed because he was actually doing the same routine. He didn't change it at all. But that was more me than him. I think that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I was a bit surprised that he went that long with the same routines.
Yeah, but what he gave you initially was an inspiration, right, to do that. Did you yourself mm-hmm. decide to put together a show that was pretty much rehearsed and did the same thing with the same facial expressions each time? Did you do that, or did you choose
nope.
improvisation?
Nope, I did improv. It just kind of like clicked in my brain that was something you could do. I appreciated him doing it. I mean, I did it a little bit. I borrowed a little bit of his energy and how he approached it, I think, a little bit. Gosh, I remember one of my first shows, I made 50 friggin' cents. That was a bad day. That was one of my first shows.
What's your favorite busker story?
My favorite one was I was doing a show. And I had a great crowd. There was probably 350, 400 people or so. It was full solid circle. And I couldn't see an empty space. You know, wherever there was an empty space, there was a head. So it looked like there were thousands of people around me. I was in the middle of my show, and this guy jumps in. A drunk guy with a guitar. You know, just he saw that how I had a great audience. And so he literally tried to steal my audience. I didn't know what to do. You know, it was like, you know, he just started singing and not too great. But the only thing I could think of doing was, okay, I'll let him play one song and then I'll get the audience to applaud him and say thank you and, you know, let him leave. So I did, and they did. And then he started playing another song. And I was saying, holy crap, what do I do? Key West has a naval base there, so there was about five or six big Navy guys that were there. And they said, let's throw him into the water. And they looked at me, and I went, okay. And I says, well, but don't throw his guitar in, and make sure he can swim. So they picked him up. The guy didn't struggle at all, because there was like five of these real muscular Navy guys. They just picked him up. threw him into the ocean, and then he just started swimming around. The audience kind of glanced over the side and applauded. I finished my show, and I did one of the best hats I had done in quite a while.
That's a good story.
I just felt like the audience was really with me that day.
So would you call that an ad lib moment? Is that the best ad lib you've ever come up with? I mean, I guess you sort of were helped out by the Navy.
I can't remember any of my ad libs particularly, but I do know that my set lines usually started out as ad libs. You know, I just look for opportunities for something to happen, and, you know, sometimes I'd think of something funny, and if it got a good reaction, it was in the show. And so my act developed that way.
How long did you hang around Key West?
I was there, started performing professionally about 78, 79, and I was there until about 83.
And then where did you go?
Then I went with Locomotion. I toured with them doing colleges. It was Jan had left the group already. When I first saw them, it was Jan who was the artistic director and the speaker. I don't know his last name. He basically developed everything that Locomotion did. You know, Bounce and Cyrus and Flip didn't say anything, really, more than a couple of words during their shows. When Jan left, it was just the three of them. And then Roger French joined them on tour. He didn't join them on street shows. And then that's when I went on tour with them, and we did colleges up and down the East Coast. And I did rope spinning, you know, with them. You know, I was basically just a techie, and, you know, did pre-shows with them. It's not like I was a full member of their show, but it was still an interesting experience.
And that year was 79, 80?
Yeah, about 80, 81, somewhere around in there. The dates are pretty fuzzy. I mean, because when you're down in Key West, it's like time just slows down. You know, even knowing what time of the year it is disappears, you know, because it's good weather all the time. So it's like summer all the time, except in the wintertime, it was pretty depressing. I worked a couple of winters down there, and I was the act at that time. You can make a living down there, but it's tough. I don't know if it's changed now, but all the other performers left, so I was down there by myself. So I got fairly good crowds, but there was about me and maybe two or three other musicians that were down there, and that was about it.
That's a Mallory Square.
Yeah. My show consisted of, my opening was, I had a trunk with all my stuff in it, and I put a super supported the top of it. I put a roller bowl on top of that and put a glass of a brandy sniffer full of orange juice in the middle of it between my legs, and then I played a couple of songs on the banjo. And then when I got through playing, I reached down and took the orange juice and drank it. And that was a pretty good opener, I thought. Everything I did, I tried to set on fire or get high, one or the other. I never did Devil Stick until I saw Will do Fire Devil Stick, and that was so popular, I went, I got to do Fire Devil Stick, you know, and did torches, did very little with my clubs. I mean, I did a few things, but I got a Diablo that was, at that time, I got it from Dave Finnegan. It was one of those bamboo ones that made noise. I just got it to make noise, and that was all I got it for. I didn't do a whole lot with it. It was funny. It was years later. I hadn't done it in a while. The string would break quite often, so I got fishing line and used fishing line, and even that would break. And so every time it broke, I would just tie it off. And I looked at it, and the thing was about a foot and a half long, and I was doing shows with a string that was like a foot and a half long. I can't believe I did it. It was like, but like I said, it was just to make noise, and then I'd move on to something that could set on fire. So the ending of my act was I would do a 6-foot unicycle, juggling torches, then do a hat routine. I did work with a partner at one time. He was a pretty good juggler. We got where we, you know, did a little bit of passing and a few other things. One thing that he learned about doing shows with me, he would put, his face would be all white. He would dress up. And he thought that that was a requirement, you know, that he had to wear white makeup. And he wouldn't talk. He was a juggler, but he did it in a mime kind of way. Then when we were doing a show, we were running late, and he didn't have time to put on his makeup. So he went out there, and he did a show. People reacted just as well or just the same as whether he did the makeup, and he just had a light bulb that went over his head and went, I don't have to wear makeup, you know, and it didn't make any difference. And I was happy that he learned that. And I got to meet a few of Locomotion friends, like Mike Williams. He's a musician. I don't know if you know him or not.
No, I don't.
Big old burly, red-headed guy. He wrote a book called Booking Yourself in the College Market, the Leap of a Small-Time Frog. And one thing that he said in that book that I liked was that the audience wants you to be successful. So if you don't get in the way, they're going to be right behind you. That's a paraphrase because I can't remember exactly. But
so was your initial idea to become a busker for, I mean, why would you go that route? Was it just because you saw it happen around you? Was it money? Was it adventure? Were you trying to get away from something or trying to find something? What were you doing when you...
Well, let's see. I always felt like I was artistic, but in visual arts. I have a degree in art. And my mother was artistic, and that's been an interest of mine for, you know, ever since I was small. So I pretty much figured at a relatively early age that I didn't want to just be a 9-to-5-er and just, you know, work at a job that I didn't like. I was going to college at the University of Georgia, and it was just one cold, rainy, wet day, and I just said, I gotta get the fuck out of here. You know, I just couldn't stand, you know, being in Georgia, and I just said, I'm going south. So I didn't move down to Key West. I didn't want to just move there without having a job or anything lined up. So I found out that there was a summer camp down there, and I went down there and taught sailing. That was in Big Pine Key. So I worked a summer teaching sailing, and then I knew I wanted to move to Key West. So I went down to Key West after that summer and got a job working for Howard Johnson's. And I was like the assistant manager, and, you know, it was nice being in paradise, but it was working a really shit job. So I didn't like that. Oh, and the same time as I had a job working for Howard Johnson's, I was working in the 3-to-5 or 3-to-11 shift. And so I had most of my days to myself. So what I would do is I would go to the beach and juggle and hang around with the street performers when they were practicing. And I taught myself how to ride a unicycle. And I could ride the unicycle at night before I went into work. I was working like 60, 70 hours a week at Howard Johnson's. Then I worked 40 hours a week at this hotel. That was still too much. Then I worked at that same hotel in the outdoor education where I taught sailing again. And I was working about 30 hours a week. That was still too much. And then I started lifeguarding at the city pool. I was working about 20 hours a week there. And then I just said, well, street performance is the only thing I got left. And so I started street performing, and I lived in my van, then eventually made enough money where I could start living indoors again and shared a house with a few people, and then eventually left Key West. Moved back, finished up my degree, got a master's degree, performed basically in Atlanta most of the time. What I'm doing now, I moved down to Mexico and lived there for about 6 years. Then I ended up teaching college down there. I went there as a student because I had to get I had to have a language to get my undergraduate degree. And so I took Spanish there because it was cheaper to go to school there than it would go to the University of Georgia and take Spanish. And I went, no brainer. you know, cultural experience and stuff.
I see.
Oh, for a while I left Key West and I went to Tallahassee and went to the Flying High Circus, and I was in the circus there.
Really? What year
and,
was that?
That was 82 or 3, somewhere in there, I think. And I did...
Dickie Brinson was
a bicycle act. What's that?
Dickie Brinson actually taught me how to juggle clubs. I went to FSU as a freshman. I actually... 1969, Dickie Brinson was the juggler in the circus, FSU Circus.
Yeah.
Adrian Catarzi was our coach. And I was a little intimidated with all of them. If you remember, way back when, President Kennedy had a physical fitness requirement for all college students. And you could satisfy that requirement for a trimester. Initially, I was in a trimester system. And for one trimester, I took the FSU circus. And I got an F. And the reason I got a failing grade, which is not really good for a pre-med student to get a failing grade in anything, you know.
Right.
It was because I couldn't press into a handstand, and that was one of the requirements. I believe there were walk a tightrope back and forth, juggle 10 times, press into a handstand, and you had to do your act. And I think there was one more, but I can't remember what it was. But I satisfied them all, but I never was able to lift my legs up and just press them from an L over my head into a handstand. I thought that was a very hard thing to do, and I still do. You had to have intense...
I never said either.
Stomach muscles and everything. Anyway, it was... I never complained to Catarzi. I mean, no one would complain to him anyway. But I was fascinated with the circus people, and so I kept showing up, even after I got my failing grade, and I was taking it for no credit. And all I did, really, was hang around Dickie Brinson and a guy named Shirley, who were the jugglers, and I would watch them.
I know Shirley.
And occasionally,
yeah, Shirley
Bob
was there.
Shirley, yeah. Occasionally, I would... They would allow me to practice with their clubs. And I would help clean up or, you know, help with the rigging because I already knew some of the stuff. And all of a sudden I got this little note in my mailbox. You have a grade change from your last trimester. And I didn't request it. I didn't ask for anything. But all of a sudden your F has been changed to an A. So Catarzi had seen me continue to show up and had decided, well, this kid's got something. He loves us or cares about us enough to, even though I gave him a failing grade, you know. So that was, it was a big time for me. And I got to tell you one other quick story. I got a chance to perform at FSU when I was doing the college market. I showed up. They put me up in some hotel or whatever it was. And I went by to see the circus people, you know, the tent, you know, the old place. Well,
yeah.
When I went down there, Dickie Brinson wasn't there at the time, but I told one of the guys, I said, oh, gee, you know, I was in the circus, you know, like, gee, oh, about 15 years ago when I was in college, and I'm doing a show here tonight, and just, you know, I was wondering, you know, I knew that Dickie was in charge now, and I just want to say, hey, just tell him Bob Nelson showed up. And, well, he showed up at the show with the entire circus troupe, all these acrobats. You know how fabulous those people were. They were just amazing performers and had all this technical ability. So I'm surrounded by, and they fed off the energy. They were just so excited to see somebody making a living doing just something similar to what they were doing. And it was just a real big kick for them, and it certainly was a big kick for me, because I never felt when I was a part of that circus or the rigor or whatever, I never felt that I was really one of them. I was always on the sideline, the guy who at most would hold a Spanish web, or maybe he would spot somebody during a routine. That was my biggest job, you know. I wasn't a circus performer at any time. And yet Dickie Brinson, at the end of that show, my hero, Dickie Brinson, my hero, walks up to me and gave me a FSU circus patch, which I still have right at my foot, right down here. In a book, I keep it. And you know as well as I do, if you're associated with them, to get that circus patch, you had to be a performer. You had to be a good one, enough to be invited to go to Callaway Gardens for the summer. And they did not give that patch out lightly. And I would never have been able to earn one. Hell, I couldn't even press into the handstand or get an A in the course on my own. And yet I had this, and I covet it to this day. And no one really, you know, I could only share that with a person like you. I can't really share that with even my wife. I go, wow, I got an FSU circus patch. She goes, oh, that's great. I says, you don't understand. This thing is like the most prized possession in the world to me. These guys would put, you know, talk about it, Jack. And I don't know when you went to high school, but when we went to high school, guys had letter sweaters, you know, the varsity football team or something. You know, that was the big thing. Do you still perform on the street? No.
Only in street fairs and stuff. I haven't done what I consider a legitimate street act in a long, long time. I'm embarrassed on what I do is I just do walk around, which I can do standing on my head. Like I said, I'm embarrassed on how little I do. It's like I feel like a Walmart greeter, you know.
Well, I understand. I understand what you're saying, but that probably has more to do with the kind of gigs that people want you to do, and they don't want you to necessarily rock the boat. You know, you get hired to do a festival.
Right, yeah, exactly. I learned a long time ago with walk around performing, what they want you to do is to attract a crowd and then disperse them, because you're secondary eye candy or something. Like if you're doing a corporate event and stuff like that, they want people to go out and do the, you know, see the booths or whatever. And
absolutely.
And you're just kind of an icebreaker. Yeah, I just, the closest thing I did to a street show was about a month ago. I did a town festival. It was Brevard's 150th anniversary, and just blocked off all the streets and stuff like that. And I basically did, you know, street shows.
Yeah. Did
but
you?
Other than that, you know, it's just private parties.
You mentioned at the very beginning of this that one of the things that disappointed you about Magical Mystical Michael was the fact that 20 years after you saw him initially, he was doing pretty much the same act. You rationalized that by saying, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I understand myself that once you find something that works, it's difficult to get away from that, especially if it's a choreographed routine. Do you feel yourself that you fell into that pattern? Have you changed? Have you grown as an artist? Are you
not
still growing?
Not as much as I probably would like. I just recently started doing stilt walking. I got some costumes. I went down to Orlando and had some custom outfits made by the same people that do Disney World. I didn't really respect street walking, but I haven't worked that much. And it's like, you know, I just figured I had to do something to get, you know, more gigs. But I like the street. I mean, I like working on the stilt walking. It's something new. You know, even though I'm 56 years old, kind of old to be, you know, learning a new skill, you know, walking stilts isn't all that hard. I did some of that down at FSU. I walked on some 16-foot stilts. You walk on those tall stilts, it's like you fall. You know,
that's
you're
going to
break a hip at least.
Yeah, it's a little bit dangerous for older guys or older girls, too.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I like a challenge. I like doing something new, and I just plan on still working on some new stuff. You know, I've gotten, like I said, lazy and just, you know, stuck with some of the, you know, just set pieces that you know, initiated down in Key West in a way, like I say, as a performer, I think I'm a better performer in some ways, but what I miss about Key West is two things, I think. Performing every single day. You know, that I got into such a rhythm of doing the show. So even though my show was basically the same, it was the, you know, this as a performer, it's the people that makes it different.
Right.
You know, and so that's the reason why, you know, initially when I said, oh, you know, Michael's doing the same act, you know, but it's like, to him, it's like the feedback he gets from the audience, which makes it still okay to do that, you know. And like I say, it's not like he's the only one that does that. And so I thought it was a quick judgment on my part, you know. And like I said, in some ways, I thought he was going to grow as a performer, and maybe he had, you know. It's just that, you know, more subtle. And, you know, because I see all these other people that you can see a big progression over a shorter period of time. You know, it might be that he just found what worked earlier. Another thing besides performing every single day is that it was a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, it was a full show, and I was responsible for it. It was something that I created, and I could develop the whole thing. But now it's just like, I do a couple of tricks, talk to some people, move on, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just not the same.
Well, I certainly understand what you're talking about with that. And I too miss the beginning, the middle, the end. And what I missed most of all, I think, is the laughter and the applause. I even have my phone now with laughter and applause from an old show I did. That's how it rings, the ringtone is. That's pretty sick, I know. Sounds pretty pathetic. But anyway, it's been good talking to you, Dave. Thanks for sharing.
Stories from the Pitch is produced by CBG Entertainment in association with Butterfly Broadcasting. To find out more about the podcast, please visit buskerhalloffame.com. The opening and closing music for today's show were tracks in the public domain available at funfunfunmedia.com. Both tracks are credited to Andy Iona, the opening track being Naughty Hula Eyes and the closing track being Pretty Red Hibiscus. If you like the podcast, I'd encourage you to visit and contribute to the companion Facebook page at facebook.com/Busker Hall of Fame. This resource continues to grow and includes great photos, videos, and other links that the internet has to offer about the world of busking. We hope you have a great week, and as you perform for audiences around the world, please remember to use your superpowers for good. I'm David Aiken, the Checkerboard Guy. Thanks for listening.